When Shizuka pictures her mother, she sees that look. Jaw clenched, thick brows nearly meeting, a look of fear and fury in her eyes. The moment they saw her, the girls froze, their smiles scattered like dandelion seeds to the wind.
"Dashilon," said Oshizuru, "go to your father."
Dashi swallowed. She bowed to Shizuka, apologized under her breath, and ran as fast as her legs could take her. And so they were alone, mother and daughter. Shizuka's face felt hot. She hadn't done anything wrong. Why was her mother so upset? Oshizuru thumbed her nose. She looked away for a moment, thinking of something her daughter couldn't fathom. Then she shook her head.
"Who told you about the daffodil, Shizuka?" she said.
Shizuka paused.
"No one," she says. "These are roses, mother. They're different." "I'm well past the age of knowing what a rose looks like,"
Shizuru cut in. Shizuka winced. Her mother's warm voice was a sword when she was upset. Oshizuru must have realized she was too severe, for she sighed and took her daughter's hand.
"Come with me," she said. "I suppose it's time you heard the story."
At the time, that walk had seemed eternal, frightening too. Her father never took her to that part of the garden. The farther in they went, the more Shizuka saw random objects sticking up out of the ground. A statue of the daughter, jade coins. Was that a bamboo mat? What were these things doing in the garden? But then she saw it, standing alone. A single golden daffodil. Shizuru sniffed.
"When your father and I were wishing for you," she said, "an old scholar told me I had to bury something I loved."
She gestured vaguely at all the detritus around the garden.
"I tried and tried with all sorts of things. But when I buried my short sword, that's when the flower showed up, gold as a sword's pommel. And then you did, not long after that. It's been here ever since." And Shizuka remembers the breeze through the garden, remembers the daffodil's quiet dance to unseen music. She reached out for the flower, but her mother touched her hand.
"Don't touch it," she said sharply.
"The scholar said, Shizuka." She took a deep breath. "The day you touch that flower is the last day in the empire. That's what he said. Do you know what that means?"
"That I be going to live with Shefali in the corn," Shizuka said, as if it were the most obvious thing in the world. Shizuru palmed her face.
"Shizuka," she said, "you and that girl, like two pine needles." At the time, Shizuka had no idea what it meant. After all, she hadn't seen Shefali in years, and when she spoke of running off to join the corn, it was just something that popped into her head. But she knew it sounded right.
"I don't like this," said Shizuru, more to herself than to her daughter.
"Changing the colors of things. Priests telling me they can't read your fortune. Flowers following you around. You should have a good life. A nice, quiet life, with none of my foolishness and too much of your father's."
A pause, and then,
"Whatever happens," said Oshizuru, "keep Shefali with you. Whatever's going on with you will also be going on with her. Now come on. Your uncle's not going to like this, and the mother knows we'll hear about it tomorrow."
Years later, Shizuka can say that her mother was right. The next morning, in full view of the court, the emperor railed against the perils of hubris, against the ungodly affront to his divine power in his garden. His thundering reprimands rained down on Oshizuru, but she remained kneeling, and if she wanted to gut her brother-in-law like a catfish, she had the good sense not to show it. Shizuka did not attend court that day. Instead, her parents swamped her with tutors. Calligraphy, poetry, zither, dance. One of them had to catch her interest. One of them would teach her calm and caution, and to consider her actions. One did, of course. Calligraphy. But Shizuka had never needed a tutor for that, beyond her brush and inkwell. But once all that was through, once she made her way home, that was when she heard the words for the first time. Her mother's voice near to breaking, her father's smooth and comforting. They had not yet noticed her.
"What if that corn woman was right, Itsuki? What if our girl is..."
"Then who better to mother her, Zuru?
Who better to keep her humble and noble? Better we raise her than Iori, and she will have Shefali, and the two of them will be like two pine needles. She will never be alone.
Iori. Had that been the emperor's name before the throne, it matched Itsuki, as was traditional for imperial children. This is the first time she'd ever heard it, but the sad venom in her father's voice left little room for doubt. Shizuka's breath caught. What were they talking about? Was this about her birthday? For she was born on the 8th day of Jidao, the 8th month, at 8 minutes into the last bell in the daughter's year. All the palace soothsayers told her it was a good omen, though they didn't use those words. They just said she was destined for greatness. They said the daughter had been born on the same day at the same time. Is that what her mother meant in the garden? A crow's creaking startled her parents. They saw her then, and their faces softened.
Shizuka, said Itsuki, first to rise. He did not wear his normal smile that day.
Shizuka, how were your lessons today?
Did you mean what you said? Shizuka wanted to ask him.
Boring.
Better boring than difficult, said Itsuki. What I would give to have a boring day, my dear.
He hugged her, fixed her hair ornaments, doted on her as he always did. But something felt different, as if she were wearing another girl's clothes, as if they were afraid of touching her. She did not sleep that night. Instead, she stood by the window staring out at the golden daffodil, surrounded by her mother's old things. In the morning, her uncle's men came for her. Twice, 8 tall men in dragon armor, twice, 8 faceless warriors with wicked spears, politely asking her to come to the gardens with them. Her mother insulting them, her father squeezing Shizuru's shoulder, telling her it would pass. When they arrived, her uncle was already there. His litter was there, at least held up by 8 men, curtained off from the early morning sun. Shizuka's mother forced her head down when they approached him.
Brother, said Itsuki, what a beautiful day the daughter has made. You should come for a walk with us. The scenery will do you good.
The scenery. They stood in front of the golden rose bush, and the men in armor had torches.
Is that what you call this, Itsuki? Said the emperor. A beautiful day, and not an affront to our divine authority.
Shizuka's chest went tight. Mother, what is he doing?
Whatever you are planning, said O Shizuru, her voice harsh. You know she meant no offense. We've been over this. She is 6 years old, Iori. 6 years old. And if you hurt her...
From inside the litter, the emperor clapped. 2 soldiers stood on each side of Shizuru. Itsuki grabbed his daughter by the shoulders.
Willful child, said the emperor. Was this your doing?
She spoke before she could think about it. Things never went well when she honed her thoughts. Then speaking became like dragging knives across her tongue.
Talk, she thought. Just talk. The words will come, and they'll fix everything. They always do.
Yes, she said. It was. All I did was change their color. If you are the son of heaven, you can change them back. Gods can do whatever they wish.
Her father squeezed her tighter.
That wasn't the reaction she wanted. He was supposed to be proud of her. He was supposed to relax.
The son of heaven, she continued, shouldn't have to tell his guards to hold my mother back either. Are you afraid of her?
Discipline her, said the emperor.
An eternal moment hung in the air, punctuated by black caws. Shizuka's heart punched against her ribs. O Shizuru stepped in front of her husband and daughter. She didn't draw the white sword at her side, but her hand was on its pommel.
Go on, she barked at the guards. Lay a hand on my daughter, and I'll lay your hand on the ground.
Shizuru, said Itsuki.
I mean it, roared Shizuru. Try me if you are so brave.
The guards all wore masks. Shizuka could not see their faces. Still, she knew they were pale.
Wearing war masks to fight humans, said Shizuru, to discipline a 6-year-old girl. How dare you?
Hold the girl down, snapped the emperor, or face imperial justice.
Shizuka remembered to this day the rattling of the guard's armor, remembers how they stood trembling in front of her mother, remembers the fear in their eyes. And she remembers her father whispering in her ear,
"Shizuka, I'm sorry, but your mother is going to hurt those men unless you kneel. Please play along, and this will be over soon."
She remembers thinking distinctly that she didn't care if those men were hurt because they served her uncle. But if her mother hurt them, then what would her uncle do? If she gave him a reason, a real reason, what if he sent Oshizuru north? What if he told the guards to kill her? Shizuka's jaw hurt. She didn't like being this afraid. She knelt. Shizuru started shouting at her father, at her uncle, at the world. Every harsh syllable made Shizuka's head pound. Fear choked her. Something awful was about to happen, wasn't it? Yes. One of the guards lit a torch, then another, then another, then another. One by one they marched toward the bushes. And the others? The others set fire to the roses, to the jasmine, to the dogwood, to the lilies, to the cherry and plum, to all the flowers she'd come to know like old friends, to all her father's favorites. Her father held her as they watched, as Shizuka screamed and screamed and screamed. That day, thinks Shizuka, that was the day she learned to truly hate her uncle. She sniffs. To a lesser extent, that was when the public learned to hate him as well. The Hokkarans, that is. The Corps knew Yoshimoto for a snake before he assumed the throne. But only the destruction of beauty appealed to the courtly, art-obsessed Hokkarans. By the time Chef Ali next visited, the gardens were coming back to life, but only just. Not that Chef Ali seems to have noticed, for the better then. The daffodil still stands, untouched, unharmed by the fire so many years ago. Shizuka, no, Empress Yui, shakes herself away from the past. She has spent long enough staring, long enough dwelling in painful memories. The book in her hands smells of pine and horses. She holds it to her nose and takes a deep breath. Part of a person's soul is in their scent, as Chef Ali would say. Shizuka has long missed this one. Let the winds of heaven blow. When we were 8, I stayed with you for the winter. Your father gave you a choice. Either you learn the naginata or the sword, he said. You may choose only one. You did not have to think about it. The sword, you said. It is about time mother recognized my talent. Your father smiled in a soft way. He reached out to muss your hair. Perhaps he decided not to. He drew back after a half a second, but the smile stayed. Are you certain, my little tigress? He said. The sword may be your mother's weapon, but it is far more dangerous. You must be closer to your opponent. If we lived in the best times, you would never have to draw your sword. If we lived in better times, you would only fight humans. But
I do not care whom I have to fight, he said.
Owitzki looked away. The smile on his face didn't change, or at least the shape of his mouth did not. Once, when he was a young man, Owitzki took the field against the Korn. He did not do much fighting. For the most part, he sat in his brother's tent, listening to their general's panic. Many times when he was a bit older, Owitzki accompanied his wife into battle. He did not do much fighting then either, but he watched good men and women writhe in agony. He watched Shizuru put them down rather than let them become monsters. He watched Shizuru slay creatures twice her size. Perhaps these things were on his mind, but they were not on yours.
I was born to hold a sword. If the gods saw fit to give my mother one, they've seen fit to give me one, too.
The gods did not give your mother her sword, Itsuki said. Her ancestors did.
My mother is an ancestor. I'll have her sword one day, you countered.
You crossed your arms. If your father had any more arguments, he did not voice them. Your teacher was selected, and swordplay was added to the schedule for your daily lessons. You left the room triumphant. For the rest of the day, it was all you could talk about.
during our walk around your gardens, you spoke of it.
A sword, Shefali, you said. At last, now that I am being properly taught, my mother will have to recognize my talent.
Only the plum trees were blossoming. We stopped beneath one of them. Was it my imagination, or did the flowers turn toward you as we approached?
I plucked one of the sprigs of flowers, already tall enough to do so. I can't say what possessed me to do it. The penalty for defacing the imperial garden is 20 lashes at minimum. Perhaps I knew you'd never go through with such a punishment. What I did know as soon as the flower was in my hand was that it deserved to be in your hair. I stopped this with a small motion, swept your hair back between your ear, and slipped the flower there. The bright pink petals echoed the ones on your favorite winter dress. What a pretty sight you were. I got the feeling it would be strange to tell you you were pretty, that you might take it differently than you did when other people said it, so I changed the subject.
Why not the Naginata?
You scoffed. The weapons of cowards, you replied. The weapon of those who think our only enemies come from the north. And so we stood beneath the plum tree and spoke of other things. You spoke, and as always, I listened. 2 days later, your mother returned from her assignment in Shiratori Province. In those days, she left often. On that particular morning, your mother returned with a man on a stretcher. We were not told what had happened, and in fact, we did not learn your mother was back until she called the two of us to meet her. We stood in the healer's rooms. She was a stooped old relic, with more bald skin than hair and more hair than teeth. And yet, despite her appearance, she was no older than 22. Such was the life of a healer. When we entered the room, she tried to shoo us away from the man in the stretcher. "This is not a sight for young eyes," she said. "But I'd seen men die before this. I did not move. And you are made of iron and fire. You did not move either."
"Leave them be, Chihiro Lao," your mother said. "They are here on my command."
"I am going to put this man down, O Shizuru-mon. You cannot wish for them to see that," she said. But your mother paid this no heed and came to kneel at our side.
"Shizuka," she said, "I understand you've chosen the sword."
"I have," you said, "and nothing you can show me will change my mind."
"I thought you might say that," said Shizuru.
"Shefali Long, have you seen what happens to those who challenge your mother?"
I thought of Borchu and nodded.
"Was it fast?"
Again I nodded.
"That is because your mother is an honorable woman," Shizuru said. "At least as long as the situation calls for it. What I am about to show you is different. If you both insist on leading a warrior's life, you must know what happens when you are not careful."
"I've done no such insisting. On the steps, you are either a warrior or a merchant or a Sanbartan, until you are old enough to simply be an old person. But I did not want to correct a woman who slew demons for a living."
"Step aside, Chihiro Lao." The healer lumbered out of her way. The man in front of us was a man in the loosest sense of the term. How long had it been since he was infected? Black coursed through his veins, black pulsed at his temples, black blossomed at his throat. His skin was pale and clammy. An unbandaged stump remained where his arm should have been. His eyes were closed, but his face contorted in pain. As we watched, shadows played beneath his skin, forming faces with two mouths and too many teeth. Sometimes we heard a popping sound, and one of his limbs would snap out of place, with the man himself not moving at all.
"This man slew a demon today," your mother said. "But he made the mistake of letting its blood mingle with his. When he dealt the beast its killing blow, a gout of it landed on the stump of his arm."
The man thrashed. Your mother drew her sword. My eyes flickered over to you. There you were, still as a noontime sun. You clenched your jaw and creased your robes with white-knuckled hands. "Ah, Shizuka, you tried so hard to tear yourself away from what you were seeing."
"He's having a violent reaction," your mother continued, stepping toward him. "Normally, he would lie in bed and rot of fever before he began thrashing."
The healer smothered him with a pillow while your mother wrapped her hands in cloth. You reached for me. Your mother made a clean slice.
There was a soft sound, then an awful smell. It was done. Shimmers clung to the underside of the pillow as the blood seeped up into it. Chihiro La winced. She looked right at the two of us and mouthed, "I'm sorry." You weren't looking at her, but I was, and I appreciated that moment of warmth. Children remember who showed them kindness when the world tried to make them cruel. This was a necessary cruelty, but it was cruelty all the same. I gave her a little bow from the chest. It was the least I could do to thank her. Satisfied that my soul wasn't lost, she made the sign of the eight over the man's body, and she bowed to your mother and left. She must have gone to fetch people to move the body. You needed at least four to do it safely, and though she was young, her body was not. It would have to be five. Oshizuru tore the cloth off her hands and wiped her blade clean. When she glanced at us, we still had linked hands. "When you use a sword, Shizuka," she said, "you must get close to your opponent, and when your opponent's blood is a poison to the gods themselves, you must be careful." Shizuru must have expected you to buckle. Instead, you ground your bare heel into the floor. "Careful," you roared. "I am O Shizuka, born on the eighth day of the eighth month, 8 minutes past the last bell. I don't need to be careful of the traitor, Mother. He needs to be careful of us." And so you turned and stormed off before your mother could say anything. You did not run. Instead, you walked as fast as you could while maintaining a degree of grace. Soon the plum trees rose above us, and soon we stood beneath it again. You stared up at it as if it offended you, and you finally snatched a fruit from it the way a queen backhands an unruly servant. "Chef Ali," you said, "promise me something." I nodded. "If I am ever foolish enough to have that happen to me, you will put me out of my misery within the day." And at this, too, I nodded. I nodded because I was eight, and you were asking me to promise something that I never thought would happen. Because we were eight, and battle was still a distant dream in our minds, no matter how often we'd seen its effects. Because we were eight, and standing beneath a plum tree, and nothing could hurt us. The next day you began your formal swordplay lessons, and yes, it is true, from the moment the wooden sword touched your hands, you were a natural. As a horse is made to run, so you were made to wield a blade. Your strokes painted bruises on your instructor like ink on paper. But I was not so talented. Hokarans favored straight swords. They're well suited to your obsession with showy duels. On horseback, it is different. A straight blade gets caught in your enemy's neck, and you can hardly stop to retrieve it. A curved blade is more practical. Your instructor was an old man from Shiratori Province. The long years of his life bent his back and hobbled his knees, but with a sword in hand, he was spry as a youth. Complicated forms were to him as simple as rising up in the morning. Perhaps easier, given his age. He'd fought in the Korean Wars against my mother. Everyone his age had. But the color of my skin was the least of his concerns. "Oshiro, sir," he'd shout, the veins in his neck pulsing. "Have you no grace? I ask for you to be flowing water. You are a cliff face." I frowned. I could be flowing water. When arrows left my bow, they were rain falling from the sky. When I was on my horse, we were the rampaging rapids of the Rakon. But put me on my feet, put a straight sword in my hand, and ask me to move like a dancer? You noticed my discomfort. As the days wore on into months and the daughter brought spring back to the lands, you insisted we go riding after sword lessons. The forests around Fujino were dense, and from your castle we could see the morning fog like a cloud come down from the heavens. It stayed until midday when Grandma the Sky called it back. White on emerald green, vibrant and pale, the sight itself refreshing and enticing. It was your great-grandfather who commissioned that forest. In his day, it was only a thick circle of green around the palace. He was an avid hunter and wanted a place to keep his more dangerous game. Here, where he kept wolves and tigers and bears, you wished to hunt. "Come," you said. "My men always go hunting in that forest. They never take me along. Too dangerous for an imperial flower, they say." Forests intimidated me as much as castles did. No roof is a good roof, whether it can be carved stone or a branch. I kept calm by remembering I'd see patches of blue, at least. Maybe I could stitch them together and make a patchwork sky. I was too distracted by my little mental sewing experiment to keep track of where we went. Only when the scent of horses came to me did I realize you'd led us all the way to the stables. How you did it without anyone questioning us is beyond me. But then again, who would ever question you? Once I realized our horses were nearby, a grin spread wide across my face. I could feel my gray nearby. I could feel her in my bones. How far would we ride? The forest was large. My gray didn't have much experience navigating thorns and brambles. Would she be all right? Perhaps I should pack extra sweets. She likes them far more than any horse of her caliber should. They're ruining her teeth. But how am I to deny her? How can anyone look into those soulful pools of brown and deny them a sweet? Your Imperial Highness, are you well? Ah, right. In Hokkaido, you had hostlers instead of tending horses yourselves. This man was your leader, if the plume on his cap was any indication. I'd forgotten his existence, and his voice startled me. Before you opened your mouth to berate him, I touched your hand. You stopped and looked at me. I pointed to our horses. Ah, that's right, he said. Then you called to him. Boy, ready our horses. Oh, she's a cushion, said the head hostler. That corn girl touched you. You waved. He scrambled to his feet and prostrated himself before you. That corn girl is Oshiro Shefali, my good friend, and you will treat her with the same respect you treat me. By then I had already begun preparing your red gelding. Hokkaido saddles are different. Where we have stirrups, a horn, and a high seat, you have little more than a flap of leather. Hokkaido believe that a rider and a horse should communicate without words. This is the corn way of thinking, too, except that we recognize the usefulness of gestures. You banished the head hostler to his chambers. I helped you up onto your horse and swung into my own saddle. The horse nickered. I ran my fingers through her mane. Again she nickered, but this time she stamped her hoof, too. A dark mood, then. So I leaned forward and whispered to her. In hushed corn, I spoke to her of sweets that awaited her at the end of the day, of the verdant places we are going, of home, of grass and wind. As the words left me, my throat thrummed with more than air. No, this was a great wind. This was the voice of something larger than myself, compressed into a whisper. It was then I realized I was no longer speaking corn. Imagine a language like swaying grass. Imagine vowels sounded like a seer's horn, consonants the rattles of bones in her cup. My tongue was thick with the taste of loam. My horse calmed. I felt like an empty river. I opened my mouth and stared at my hands and tried to understand what had just happened. And as I did whenever I was confused, I turned to you. And there you were, sitting atop your horse like a throne. When you saw the expression on my face, your brows knit together. Shefali? I closed my eyes and squeezed my hands together. Opening them took some effort. Were they still mine, or were they too the tools of something else? You urged your horse toward me. They are just outside the royal stables. You squeezed my shoulder. Golden butterflies pinned to your hair fluttered the closer you moved. Shefali, you said. I licked my dry lips. A deep rattling breath shook me. I am all right, I said. You aren't, you said. Do not lie to me. I know you as I know my reflection. What happened? I met your eyes. I could not meet them long. The second we locked gazes, my chest throbbed and ached and rang with a note I did not recognize. You two flinched. Your wing-covered hand flew to your heart. Did you? You asked. I nodded. When you turned to look around us, the ornaments in your hair sounded like temple bells. A messenger rode up toward the stable cloaked in yellow and white, the colors of Shiseki Province. Upon seeing you, he bowed at the waist still mounted. Oh, Shizuka-shun, flower of the Empire, you honor me with your presence. Even at 8, you did not bat an eye at such praise. If anything, I think it exhausted you. When it came to you, the public knew only three ways to speak. The hustlers earlier demonstrated mindless concern. To those people, you were not a girl, but a precious, frail object. The second thing a person might do was to praise your parents. This did not trouble you much on its own, but by the third or fourth time you heard someone remark on your semblance to your mother, you made your excuses to leave. And here was the last, mindless praise from a passing messenger. Seeing you alone was considered a great honor. You did not have to further honor him with words. No doubt this messenger would tell his family all he could about you, the colors you were wearing, the way you carried yourself, the small nod you gave him as he left. Perhaps he'd mention how long your sleeves were, or the elaborate dragons embroidered in gold upon them. If he was an astute man, he'd mention the chrysanthemum secreted away by your wrists. But he would not have mentioned how your hand gripped my wrist, how you squeezed mine when he called to you. Long sleeves hide many secrets. "We're going," he said. "We cannot talk here." I nodded. Together we made our way out of your lands. In spite of our age, no one questioned us. Why would they? You, the imperial niece, were old enough to go out on a ride if you so wished. You had company. Corn company, yes, but that was perhaps for the best. Everyone knows my people are born on horseback and sired by stallions. On any other day, you considered silence an enemy you must cut down. As our horses took us from the palace of Fujino deep into the green forests surrounding it, you spoke not a word. But then, neither did I. I was marveling at the trees, for one, wondering how anything the gods created could be so tall, wondering what it would be like to climb onto the highest branches of the tallest tree we passed. What did your palace look like from there? Which was taller, a tree that grew from a sapling over dozens of years, or a palace men raised with their own hands? After 5 hours of riding in silence, I called for a stop. Our horses needed water and rest. We stopped in a relatively light portion of the forest. A small pool lay beneath the trees. From it our horses drank. From the grass surrounding it, they ate. And as for us? I laid out a thick felt blanket made by my grandmother. At one time it had been white, but the grit and grime and sweat and smoke of our lives tinged it gray. My mother let me take it from her care before leaving me with you. Such a thing was normally not permitted. But then, I would normally not be leaving the gear for so long. On this blanket you sat. On this blanket, with wool taken from my grandmother's flock. Your dress was blood on smoke. "Chef Ali," you said, "have you ever seen a man die, besides the tainted one my mother killed?" I started. What sort of question was that? And yet, Borchu calling me a coward, claiming my Hokaran blood made me weak. The sight of him crumpling to the ground. I nodded. Clouds shaded your brow. The bright ornaments of your hair could not illuminate the darkness of your mood. When you spoke next, you stared at the ground. "Chef Ali," he said. As an inkbrush tints the water it touches, so did fear darken your voice. "What do you see when men die?" My lips were dry, dew on every leaf near us. But my lips were dry, because I knew the answer. "Their souls," I said. "I see their souls." On the blanket your hand twitched. You huddled on yourself. "Shizuka." "Right before I was born," you said, "my mother was with yours out on the steps." I tilted my head. This I had not known. What was Shizuru doing on the steps in such a state? For my mother, it is to be expected. But for a Hokaran woman with moon belly to be riding? To be riding in the winter? And people say that you are foolhardy. "Alshara insisted on taking my mother to an oracle before the week was out," you continued. "And in this, as in all things, my mother listened to yours." "The oracle could not read my future," you said. "When her bones fell to the ground, they shattered into dozens of tiny pieces. She said she'd heard of that happening in stories in the presence of gods. So they went to another oracle, and another. Every time they tried to read my fortune, the same thing happened. Hokan fortune tellers only said my birthday was important. They couldn't say anything about my future." Around us, 100 creatures lived in their small lives.
Trees and roots and mushrooms alike bathed in the fading light of the sun. Trickling down through the branches, the sun painted us too, with streaks of white and yellow, with bright patches like oases on our shaded faces. As the priests told things, each of those animals, each of those plants, and even the rocks around us were gods. Some gods are grains of sand. Some are grandmother sky. A god can be anything it wishes, as small or as large as it pleases. A god may live in a singing girl's zither, imbuing each note with the sweetness of a ripe plum. A god may choose a scabbard as its home and lend any blade it touches sharpness unmatched. Or God might also live in a crock and burn everything it comes into contact with. Gods can be anything. But could we be gods? Two pine needles, my mother always said, like two pine needles. He pointed to a particular tree some distance away. Perched on one of its branches was a bright green songbird, the sort people travel into forests specifically to catch. At the right market, it would fetch a fine price. If I asked you to shoot that bird, you asked, you would be able to, would you not? I frowned. I didn't really want to shoot that bird. Someone hungrier than we were might need it in the future. Nevertheless, I swallowed my protests and nodded. Sitting here with me on this blanket, you said, you could draw your bow, fire an arrow, and rob this forest of a singer. It would not be an easy thing to do. Corn bows are made to be fired from compact spaces. Sitting was not the issue. Drawing without startling the creature would be the problem. And yet I knew I could do it. As that same bird was born knowing 100 songs, I was born knowing 100 ways to fire a bow. Does it not occur to you how strange that is? Strange was a walking fish. Strange was water spreading out across the horizon no matter where you looked. Being able to hunt was not strange. It was a skill I needed if I was going to feed myself out on the steps. You are 8. I gave you a level look. You are 8 and you can strike a target as small as my fist from this far away, you said. Chevali, there are grown men who cannot do that. Then they would starve, I said. You sighed and shook your head. Earlier, you said, when you spoke to your horse, did you not feel strange? Did you not feel like someone else's inkbrush? I stared at the back of my hands. Warm brown skin, pockmarked here and there with unhealing white. If I made a fist, I could see my pulse throbbing. I counted the beats, waited for you to continue. If someone was using me as their brush, what were they writing? You swallowed. Near to us was a shrub full of blossoms I could not name. They were all bright violet. So bright. I did not like to look at them. You reached out toward one of them. It struck me that your hand shook, that there was this fear in your eyes you cut down like an enemy on the field. When your fingertips met the petals, they turned from violet to gold. A soft sound escaped me, and I covered my mouth in surprise. Chevali, you said, and you took my hand in yours. I could not help but stare at you. Your pleading mouth, your wide eyes. As candles are not stars, we are not like the others. You must promise me, no matter what, that we will always find our way back to each other. Your words hammered against the bell of my soul. I promise, I said, together. Swear it, you said. A fire of youthful conviction filled you. Swear it to me. Without hesitation, I stood up and walked to the great white tree on which the songbird sat. When you walked to me, it was without fear, without a trace of nervousness. I drew an arrow from the quiver hanging at my hip. I held out my hand, the flat of the arrowhead resting on my palm. Then, together we cut our palms against it. Sharp pain jolted through us, and yet neither of us flinched. When I drew my hand back, the arrowhead was dark with blood. It stuck to my palm, and it was only with some effort that I removed it. Then I knocked the arrow. Sweat and grime from my grip pressed into the weeping wound we'd just made. When I drew back the bowstring, when the pressure against my palm set my whole arm alight, when the pain screamed inside me, when all these things happened,
I pointed my bow at the sun. I swear by the sky and blood, I said.
I swear by my mother's gear and my grandmother's spirit. I swear by the blood of Grandmother Sky, who birthed the corn and taught us to saddle lightning.
Together, I swear this. Only then did I loose. Like the songbird, the arrow soared overhead, straight on toward the sun. I turned before it reached the peak of its arch. Once Grandmother Sky tastes your blood, you may not hide from your oath. Where can you go to hide from her bright golden eye, or the dull silver one? All things return to the sky in time. As we walked back to the blanket we called our camp, I wondered if we would return to the sky. Only the stars and the clouds deserve to be in your company. Only the sky could be home to you. Only the sky was a splendid enough throne for you. We stayed in the clearing that night. I urged you to let us ride back, or at least to ride towards somewhere a little better populated. But you insisted in your bullheaded way that we could stay wherever we pleased. After all, hadn't you just told me that we were not normal? I did not like that. It was the sort of thing said by a girl who has never had to keep watch for wolves in the dark of night. And so, as you crept into my tent to sleep, I set about bundling together our belongings and hanging them from a tree. Once this was done, I sat before the fire and resigned myself to a sleepless night. It rained not long after you went to bed. My fire, reduced to smoldering cinders, did not give me much light. I slipped my arms inside my lined coat and huddled closer to the embers. Yes, I remember the orange of the cinders, the low rumbles of the night creatures. I remember rain on the leaves and their fresh green smell. I remember closing my eyes and listening to the 100,000 sounds of life. I tilted my head back and let the rain fall into my mouth. When it rained in the steppes, we'd put out every bull we could to catch it. 100 li away, my mother and cousins were running out into the darkness. They turn and dance and sing praises to the sky. In Shenglai, so far away, I could not imagine its distance. My father and brother slept in their warm beds. And Shiro might be awake. Knowing him, he'd be sitting up in bed, looking out the window. In his hands, I picture a brush. On his mind, poetry. He kept writing to me of Lord Lei's youngest daughter. Kinshira said she was more beautiful than the wind through a silver horse's mane, which might be the wrongest thing I've ever heard. How could he look on you and say such a thing about any other woman? But love makes fools, as they say. And in my brother's case, it drove him to write terrible courtship poetry. Thick drops of rain fell like beets. 1, 2, 3, 4... 5. And then there is you, asleep in my tent, not even a length away from me, yet given over to the world of dreams. I wondered what you dreamed of. I wondered if you were safe. By the time dawn came upon me, my eyes were heavy with sand. I rose and moved toward the tent. It was then that I saw the tiger. You must understand, I did not hear it, did not see it before this moment. A creature 3-4 times my size moved with the silence of death itself. Your ancestor, Minami Shiori, hunted tigers for sport. Looking at the beast now, I did not know how she did it. Every sinew in its body, every muscle tensed for attack. Great green eyes froze me in place. So astounded was I that I did not notice the beast was hurt. Yes, yes, as it turned toward me, I saw dried blood on its paws like rust. On its side, a yawning mouth of a wound. On its side, claw marks. Red was its muzzle. Red its teeth. I did not know if tigers traveled in packs. I'd only heard of them in stories. There was only ever one tiger in the stories. Perhaps they were not like lone wolves or lone corn. But this one? This one was. I knew that look in its eyes. I licked my lips. The tiger crouched down. I'd seen cats do the same sort of thing when they were about to pounce on mice. I did what any corn would do. I mounted my horse and drew my bow in a smooth ripple of movement. My palm still ached from the wound, but I did not have time to dwell on it. "Shizuka," I shouted.
Hopefully the sound of my raising voice was enough to rouse you. If not, perhaps hooves pounding against the undergrowth would. The tiger leapt forward, landing not far from me and my horse. In the moment before I kicked into gallop, I found myself in awe. On the steps, we have only these animals, stoats, sheep, dogs, wolves, birds, and horses. For most of my life, I was surrounded by these creatures. I knew the best place to aim when hunting a stoat. I knew how to skin a wolf. I could talk to horses if I wanted. But never in my life had I seen anything so graceful as that tiger. The sun herself sang its praises, spinning gold from the orange of its fur, turning the black to brush strokes. As it stalked us, I saw its thick muscles sliding beneath its skin, like eels beneath a river. We were wolves once, we Corin, but there was nothing wolfish about that creature. When I looked into its great eyes, I did not see anything human. I didn't see anything I recognized. How could something so large move with such fluidity? With those bright stripes, how could it hide in the forest? What did it eat? It did not belong here, I decided. That was why it was so lean. That was why it was covered in battle wounds. Whoever the game master of this forest was had captured it and placed it here. But this was never its choice. I frowned. I knew a bit of what it was like to be dropped into a forest you hate. And so something about its terrible beauty was familiar to me, like a favorite song forgotten. But it was trying to kill me. I could not admire it for long. I loosed an arrow at it as my horse pulled ahead. With a satisfying thunk, the arrow pierced the beast's pelt, a solid blow to its chest. A gout of blood watered the roots. The tiger roared, clawed at the ground, and then it began running. Riding through the forest is a difficult thing to do given the best conditions. Corn horses are trained for speed and endurance, not sure-footedness. A good Hokkaran gelding would be ideal here. But I did not have a good Hokkaran gelding. I had a Corin mare with a blackened steel coat and fire in her heart. As we barreled through the trees, I ducked low-hanging branches, whispered to her, told her we were going to make it out of this. I had to trust her. How else could I fire at the tiger? I could not guide us through the forest and aim. It was one or the other. I thought of you scrambling awake in the tent. I thought of you watching the tiger follow me into the vast green growth. Inside me was the thrumming power of 100 horsemen, the light of 100 dawns, the fire of 100 clans meeting together. In the moment I realized this, a strange calm came over me. My horse could handle the woods as long as I handled the tiger. Another arrow, another, another, each found its mark. First one of its paws, then its haunches, then its flank. Whatever agony the beast was in, it did not stop chasing me. My horse may be the fastest in the Burkila line, but it cannot outrun something that has lived and breathed this forest, as I have lived and breathed sand and grass and snow. The tiger jumped up onto a tree. I knocked an arrow. Could I hit a target small as my palm while it was moving? Could I hit it while I was moving? Could I hit it while seated? I loosed. The arrow whistled through the air. There! It hit the tiger in the eye. The beast recoiled. But it did not stop. My heart hammered in my chest. It was going to jump. It was going to jump from the tree, and it was going to land on my horse and me. And there was nothing I could do to stop it. I held her mane in my hand and flattened myself against her warm back. I took a deep breath and braced myself for what was coming. Would my mother be proud of me? Wood creaking. The tiger in the air. Claws tearing through my deal, tearing through my skin, bearing my bone to the world. Red. 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 Rank breath thick with the smell of corpses. Hot blood washing over my arm. A roar. Chef Ali! I forced my eyes open. You stood before us. But how? Unless... Yes, this was the camp. My horse, wily as ever, had led us in a circle. There you were with your blunted training sword. There you were standing tall and proud in the face of this horrible creature. I opened my mouth to shout at you, tell you to run. You charged ahead,
the beast, woozy from lack of blood, clawed at you. As fire crackling, you moved away. I could not let you do this alone, no matter how much pain I was in. Drawing my bow was so agonizing. I thought I might pass out, but I could not allow myself to, not when you were in danger. My hands shook. This would not hit. This was not going to hit. There was no way. I loosed. Another arrow landed in the beast's neck near its shoulder. You let out a roar to rival the tiger's. Then you plunged your sword into its stomach. I was dizzy, swaying, straining to open my eyes as my body fought to shut them. Coldness cut through me like winter's harsh knife. Pain grabbed me by the shoulder and pulled, pulled, until my boot slid out of the stirrups and... The last thing I saw before I fell off my horse, you under the morning sun, covered in the tiger's blood, your dull blade alight with dawn's fire. When I awoke, you sat next to my bed. Weary lines dug their way onto your heart-shaped young face. Either your attendants had not seen you, or you did not let them touch you. The many knots and ornaments in your hair hung in disarray. Still, you wore the red and gold dress. "Chevalier," you said as you touched my shoulder. If I wore the ragged remnants of sleep, that touch and its resulting pain tore them off me. I screamed. You drew back and bit your lip. "I did not mean to hurt you," you said. "It's the tiger's fault for wounding you there." I frowned. You glanced away, hiding your hand within your wet sleeves. These were your rooms in Fujino. In each corner a different treasure, given to you by a courtier to try to curry favor. A golden statue of the mother. An intricate porcelain doll dressed in identical clothing to yours. A calligraphy set. Fine parchments. Gold leaf ink. A bamboo screen painted with Oshizuru's story. "My mother will be here soon," you said. "Be ready. She is not pleased with either of us, though I imagine she will take it easier on you." I tilted my head, gestured around the room with my good hand. You understood me without my having to speak. "After the incident," you said, "I rode out to find the nearest guards. When I explained what happened, they followed me to camp. I carried you back and graciously allowed them to carry the tiger. My parents have no idea what to do with it. I have informed them that it is your decision to make, by any rules that matter." Your mother was not going to listen to that, and you knew it. But your father would. No doubt he found the whole situation poetic. A boon for us, then, if your father put ink to parchment in our behalf. I pointed to my shoulder. "Torn," you said. "We brought in a healer. Not a very good one." You shifted in your seat, picked at your nails. At court, the latest fashion was to dust one's fingertips in crushed gems, mixed with oils and lotions. Between when I passed out and that moment, you dipped yours in crushed garnets. "She said that healing you was beyond her power," you said. "It's my opinion that if you call yourself a thing, and you cannot do that thing, then you are nothing at all. But that is my opinion. And as always, my parents do not want to listen to me." So the healer was compensated for her utter lack of work. With some effort and some help from you, I sat up. Breath came in rattles. "When I was 6, one of the Brakila clan riders came back from a hunt with his left arm in his right hand, his entire left arm. His left shoulder was a bloody stump. He and his horse were cloaked in rusty brown. Everyone ran to him. The woman carried him off in his horse and took him to the oracle's tent. 2 sheep were brought in, too, and I remember hearing the shrill cries they made. When my mother sent me to get the oracle's blessing on her choice of camp a few days later, I saw the man. Sweat beaded on his brow like dew. Fever painted his brown face red. But his arm was attached again. I reached for my own arm. It was still there. Why then was I beyond healing? I thought of our promise. I grunted. "I agree," he said. "On the bright side, we do not have to attend court until you are healed." Small victories. Standing on my feet beneath a jade ceiling listening to Hokarin's prattle, was there any worse fate? At least, they would not stare at me. "Shizuka, you say that as if it's a fitting reward for your foolish decisions." "Ah,
Oshizuru opened the door. You sat a bit straighter, though I'm not certain you meant to. You will accompany me to court tomorrow. Your uncle has been asking about you at any rate. Before the night is through, you shall write one of your father's poems for him on fine white paper. You tugged at your sleeves rather than roll your eyes. If you rolled your eyes, you were lost. Your mother was a force to be reckoned with when she was in the most pleasant of moods. Now worry and anger clouded her features. My mother may have conquered half of Hokkara with nothing but horsemen and dragon's fire, but bandits had whole rituals dedicated to keeping your mother at bay. Right then, I would have liked a ritual or two. Your mother fixed me with a harsh, unyielding glare. Her brown eyes became slabs of earth, her mouth a canyon. Shara, said Oshizuru, the only person who could call my mother that and live, is never going to believe me. I drew back. The clouds broke. She cracked a smile. 2 8-year-olds attacked by a tiger, and neither of them dead, she said. If I told her that story, she'd give me a look. Her look. And yet, here we are. What was I to say to that? Not a word of it was wrong. Just, when she put it that way, we did sound foolish. Your mother cleared her throat. How is your shoulder? I held up my hand and closed it tight into a fist. She nodded. Yes, she said. It's going to hurt for some time. The healer couldn't do much. The doctors say it'll be at least a few months before you can shoot a bow with that arm again. Wrong. I'd be shooting a bow again within a few weeks at most. My young brain could not imagine a life where I went any longer than that without firing it. I'd ask you what happened, said your mother. But you've never been one for words. So I will tell you this. Now the solemnity crept back in. Now her words were heavy as the first rain of the season. What you did was foolish. Beyond foolish. If a man strapped raw meat to his person and ran to the emperor's dogs, that would be less foolish. You are children. They are grown warriors who'd never dream of fighting a tiger. You lived this time. Next time you will not. It is by the mother's intervention alone that you live. I wanted to say something. At the base of my throat, I felt it building. I wanted to tell her that no, it was not the mother's grace. It was my own skill at riding. It was my horse. It was your blade striking the final blow. It was us. But no. No, it was not the time. So I sat. I sat and listened as your mother outlined all the things we'd done wrong. As she told us again and again how foolish we'd been. There are bandits in those woods, she said. What would you have done if they came for you? Shot them, you said. However long she'd lectured you before I awoke, you could take no more. She would have shot them, mother, as she shot the tiger, repeatedly. Men are not tigers, Oshizuru snapped. I'd rather fight a beast. At least they have dignity. Those men would have cut your horse's legs out from... I yelped and drew the covers around my knees. My brown face went lighter. My mouth hung open. My breath left me in harsh gasps. Your mother reached out a hand. No doubt it was meant to be reassuring. But the thought of my horse being hurt was still on my mind. The image of her crumpling as some godless bandit cut into her. Her cries of pain rang in my ears. I pressed my head against the pillows to drown it out. You whispered something to your mother. The Queen of Crows eyed me and sighed. Shefalilang, she said. No one is going to hurt your horse. I peeked out from my self-imposed exile and wrinkled my face. Your mother pinched the bridge of her nose. Don't give me that look, she said. You are on our lands. If anyone hurt your horse while you were lying here, I would execute them myself. Slowly, slowly I began to relax, but the look in her eyes still brooked no arguments. This changes nothing, she said. However incredible it is you slew the tiger, it was a foolish thing to do. You should have run, Shefali. You should have taken Shizuka up on your horse and the two of you should have gotten away somewhere safe. I hung my head. People will tell you what you did was brave, Shizuru said, my husband among them. But you must remember how easily it could have gone wrong. This wound you bear will scar. When you feel stiff skin tugging in your shoulder, you will remember.
and I drew the sheets closer to myself. I clutched them close, my throat tightened,